This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, Al-Qaeda's last stand. Osama bin Laden's forces are chased to one last base in the mountains. Bin Laden himself may be holed up in the caves of Tora Bora. As tonight's 10:30 surrender or else deadline looms, so does the question. Is this an ending or a new beginning in the war on terror? In this hour, breaking news developments and a careful look ahead to where the battle could go from here. We begin with the latest news on the ground in Tora Bora. Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's Military Weekly. I asked him if the endgame is in sight and what that would mean.
Well, it looks like it, but in Afghanistan, you can never be totally sure. And although we're hearing that Al-Qaeda fighters might be surrendering tomorrow morning, it may well be that these are just a rear party that have been there to try and delay Allied troops while some of the other Al-Qaeda fighters slip away into Pakistan. So we really have to have a look and see what comes up tomorrow, if in fact they do surrender, if they haven't just been playing for yet more time. So we can't really say until we see what comes out tomorrow.
What will it take to know whether they're defeated or they're still hiding deep in the mountain or they're gone?
That's going to be really, really difficult. At some stage, someone's going to have to make a decision about whether a coalition operation should continue in Afghanistan in the way they're doing at the moment, or they will actually stop. There'll be a lot of intelligence in the next few weeks, mainly taken probably from local fighters, about whether there are Al-Qaeda, whether there are Taliban still around. And as those intelligence reports start to diminish, there will come a time when the people at CENTCOM can say, well, this is as much as we can possibly do here. We have broken Al-Qaeda inside Afghanistan, and that was the aim of the operation. But we're not there yet. We're probably a few weeks away from that sort of decision yet.
At Tora Bora itself, do you expect that troops will have to go down into the caves? Will they be U.S. troops? What kind of weaponry might they use in that setting?
Right at this moment in time, as far as we can make out, there aren't many U.S. troops around the Tora Bora area specifically. They will probably get some local Northern Alliance or Eastern Alliance, as they're calling themselves, their fighters to go down and have a look around. And in one or two places, there might be something interesting where U.S. troops might have to go and have a look and see what they can find. But that's farther down the line, and it's beginning to look as though it may not be 100% necessary.
Is the terrain around this area rough enough that a substantial number of Al-Qaeda fighters could have blended over the border into Pakistan?
Yes, it is. Yeah. We've been looking very carefully at the large-scale maps over the last few days. It is the most horrendous sort of area. It is terribly rugged, and we're already seeing people getting into Afghanistan and turning up at various places in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And in addition, there are lots of reports about Al-Qaeda fighters having made it out of Afghanistan and back into the Gulf, into the UAE, and some say in Kuwait as well.
Is that what you expect, a dispersal across the region, or to stay in some kind of concentration in Pakistan? Are they likely to just go into civilian clothes and go home?
They're liable to go into civilian clothes, and they're liable to hide in the centers of population inside the Middle East, places where there are very, very large numbers of people, places like Peshawar, Islamabad, maybe as far away as Cairo. We've got to remember that their job is not to stand and die. They gain nothing mm-hmm. from that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they will be looking at themselves very carefully and saying, we have got to get away and we have to live to fight another day. And this is the way that guerrillas, these sort of people, actually think. So I think the chances of getting large numbers of Al-Qaeda out of somewhere like Tora Bora are slim. And I think that they will be behaving in the classic guerrilla fashion, dispersing and hiding in the areas where they can best hold out for as long as they can. Probably means the teeming urban areas.
On the other side of the Tora Bora encounter then, how long would you expect U.S. forces to remain in Afghanistan?
I think we're going to see some sort of U.S. presence for quite a long time. When I say a long time, at least a month, 6 weeks. And probably U.S. forces will thin out and start to move out once there is some form of reasonably credible UN security force on the ground in Afghanistan.
Thin out and move out to where? Does this mean we'll begin to see the aircraft carriers depart the region, the heavy equipment that they've brought in moved back to the U.S. or something else?
Well, I think we'll see a lot of it probably moving into the Gulf. I think this is an unfinished story, and almost certainly the U.S. will bring military and diplomatic pressure to bear on countries like the Sudan, Somalia, the Yemen, And probably in the long term, this one won't be finished until the problem of Iraq has been finally solved.
What about peacekeeping and the military required to do that? The UK has been asked to pick up leadership of that effort. Is the United Kingdom prepared to do that? And what size of forces will be required to do the peacekeeping, nation building in Afghanistan?
Well, we know that the UN wants a large force in Afghanistan, and we know that the UN wants the British to lead that force and to be the lead country, certainly in the initial phases. The UN wants to put a force in of around about 20,000 plus. The UK, at the moment, has got a divisional headquarters and a brigade headquarters, we believe, earmarked for this, with a complete brigade on top of that, another 6,000 troops. And we think the French and various other people are going to come in on this force as well. The sticking point here, of course, is the agreement of the factions in Afghanistan and specifically Kabul at the moment. And Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN special envoy in Afghanistan, isn't having an awful lot of success tonight with the talks that are going on at the moment.
I mean, the problem being whether or not they will accept, welcome, and embrace these troops?
That's absolutely right. Some analysts who are particularly cynical are saying that basically the Northern Alliance is the sticking point, and the Northern Alliance sees a UN force on the ground in Afghanistan as a barrier to their ability to, I wouldn't say steal, but certainly to appropriate lots and lots of money and various goodies that might come with any UN reconstruction package.
But is the UN or the international community prepared to have this peacekeeping force blocked by the local factions?
I don't think so, and I think that that may sink in over the next 48 hours. I think that by the end of the week, the Northern Alliance's objections will be overcome, and I think we'll see this peacekeeping force going in. Or peace support operation is a better way to describe it. I mean, there is no doubt that it must go down on the ground if reconstruction and UN funds, international money, is to be pumped into Afghanistan for reconstruction in the future.
Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's Military Weekly. He spoke to us from Shrewsbury, England. In this open-ended war on terror, nothing is carved in granite except the caves of Tora Bora and maybe Osama bin Laden's fight-to-the-death mindset. But while military victory in Afghanistan now appears all but complete, there are plenty of other uncertainties for the U.S.-led coalition and the American people. Where does the war go from here? Will bin Laden be caught in the Afghan caves? And even if he is, will it stop al-Qaeda? Will the tentacles of terrorism live on? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Virginia is Michael Vickers. He's a former CIA and Special Forces officer and now Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington. Good evening, Michael Vickers.
Good evening.
You just heard the interview with Charles Heyman in London. Do you agree with what he said about future hotspots where al-Qaeda members could be heading and blending in?
Yes, although I think it may be quite difficult for them to actually get to some of those locations. There's been reports that some al-Qaeda troops may have crossed the border and some may have bought passage to Iran, particularly from the north. But there still seems to be a fair amount of evidence that bin Laden, for example, is still in eastern Afghanistan and Mullah Omar is in southern Afghanistan.
There have been a lot of troops and equipment deployed to cut off paths both by air and sea out of the immediate area, haven't there?
Yes, there has, although the Pakistani border is long and it is porous and difficult to seal off completely.
We're all watching from a distance here and acknowledging that, but right now there's an 8 a.m. Tora Bora time deadline. That's 10:30 here just in a couple hours from now, reportedly for bin Laden's troops to surrender. What do you expect to happen?
Well, those troops really are on their last ropes. They've been driven from position to position, not only by U.S. air power from several caves in the Tora Bora and also Malawa area to the east, but also by a three-pronged opposition attack. And while they put up a fairly fierce fight over several days with mm-hmm. mortars and small arms, they're now really on their last legs and have been trying to negotiate a surrender. And there are reports of dissension in their ranks, some al-Qaeda fighters wanting to give up because others are basically cutting and running.
So if they surrender or they're finally driven out and captured there at Tora Bora, is that essentially, effectively the end of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, or is it likely to flare up elsewhere in guerrilla confrontations we haven't yet heard about?
Well, I think it really is pretty much the end of not only al-Qaeda, but Taliban rule already in Afghanistan. That doesn't mean some al-Qaeda fighters couldn't move elsewhere, but that organization has really suffered a number of blows around the world, particularly in Europe recently. And so there aren't too many places left for them to go, and one would think other organizations might assume their mantle in the future rather than them regenerating themselves.
Well, I guess that's really the big question, isn't it? How much it means to win in Afghanistan? You're suggesting that the disruption has been severe enough that the global operations of al-Qaeda may be defanged.
Yes, I think there really have been a two-pronged blow against al-Qaeda. One, a lot of their leadership has been in Afghanistan, and they've had state support there. That state support is over, and their leadership is either killed or really on the run as of now. Their number three leader, Mohammed Atef, who supposedly planned the September 11th attacks, mm-hmm. has been killed. The number two, or maybe even number one, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has either been killed or injured, and a lot of his family killed. And of course, the regime has been destroyed. And then, most also importantly, their network around the world in Spain and in Germany has been severely disrupted.
Well, but that part of it has been less obvious. We've at least had reports of what's going on militarily, but the disruption of cells around the world has not been so clear. You're not buying that there could remain a rich network of fairly autonomous cells that could carry out acts of terrorism on their own without direction from Afghanistan?
Well, I think there's a decentralized network, but I think a lot of it has been disrupted and will be continued to be disrupted. There's a fairly active presence in Southeast Asia, and in particular in the Philippines, that have planned a number of attacks over the last several years, which thankfully have been foiled. But we're now providing significant security assistance to the Philippine government, and that will make it more difficult for those forces to operate there.
So what's been the arm of the law that has disrupted cells around the world? We haven't heard of that many arrests of al-Qaeda members.
Well, there's been some in Germany and some in Spain, and the Sudanese and the Yemenis, for example, have been cooperating more than they have in the past. There have been some arrests in Uzbekistan. The IMU in Uzbekistan has been one of the Islamic groups closely affiliated with al-Qaeda. There still are a fairly large North African population in Europe that still has al-Qaeda sympathies that may not have gotten to the bottom of that. But it's been a pretty good global victory by a number of cooperative governments.
This brings to mind the videotape, which has not been seen outside government circles, but reportedly shows Osama bin Laden anticipating the second plane hitting the World Trade Center. And the Bush administration suggests that his involvement was very close. Your view seems to jive with that this really was a headquarters, that things really were directed out of these caves and redoubts in Afghanistan, and that without that, al-Qaeda won't have much operational capacity.
Yeah, from what I understand, not only does bin Laden express pleasure at the results, he also describes that several members of the group didn't know they were on a suicide mission. And so that suggests a fairly good amount of command and control. There also have been a lot of documents that are being recovered in Afghanistan, as well as computer disks and other things that suggests that these guys really weren't just operating by carrier pigeon or face-to-face communications, that they were more sophisticated than that.
Still, it's quite something to imagine these orders going out from Tora Bora and elsewhere in Afghanistan all the way to New Jersey and Florida and Minnesota, but that's exactly what you are suggesting.
Well, the operation that seems to have been directed in Europe, as I understand it, has an element of decentralization in it, but there was significant command and control by this Mohammed Atta in Europe, and then planned in Afghanistan by this Mohammed Atef.
Michael Vickers, we've got to take a short break. We're talking about al-Qaeda's last stand and how great a blow it is to the terrorist network that all of America and the world has been watching this fall. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can join the conversation. Where do we go now in the war on terrorism? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. While a battlefield deadline for surrender fast approaches and the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden are still unknown, President Bush gave this warning today in a speech at the Citadel.
The Taliban and the terrorists set out to dominate a country and intimidate the world. Today, from their caves, it's all looking a little different. And no cave. And no cave is deep enough to escape the patient justice of the United States of America.
That was President Bush speaking today at the Citadel in South Carolina. We're talking about Al-Qaeda's last stand and where the war on terrorism goes from here. Among the questions, will the Afghan campaign feel like a victory without Osama bin Laden being tracked down? At this hour, he has not been, as far as we know. We're joined by Michael Vickers. He's a former CIA and Special Forces officer. He's now Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, an independent policy research group in Washington, D.C. Michael Vickers, you heard along with us the cadets at the Citadel in with President Bush on the joke about how the war on terrorism looks now from the haze of Afghanistan. But we've been warned for weeks and months that this could go on for a long time, and that even now in this Christmas season, there may be attacks in the United States. Is it too soon to be chuckling?
Well, Afghanistan is only really the first phase of this problem, and it's gone better than I think a lot of people have expected. Mm-hmm. Taliban collapsed a lot sooner, and the victory came a lot easier than people thought. But that doesn't mean this long-term struggle is over by any means. And I think that's what administration officials are really cautioning.
What about Osama bin Laden himself? You know, we've heard every opinion there is, whether he's in Afghanistan, even in the region, well beyond it. You're suggesting that the chances are good that he may still be right around this Tora Bora mountain concave region where the noose is being tightened tonight.
Yeah, most evidence, from what I understand, seems to suggest he's still there, although there are other reports that suggest that he's trying to flee from his troops, basically sacrifice them, and hence the impetus to negotiations, but still in the broader area. No, but as Secretary Rumsfeld has said, it's possible he could slip across the border. But you know, the Pakistanis are also looking for him, and so it's not a trivial matter.
So, if U.S. or Afghan forces want to go in and find him, what will they have to do? How will they do it?
Well, now the problem is really getting reduced to just finding him and Mullah Omar as a fugitive, because they've been stripped a lot of their bodyguards. Where formerly they had, you know, 1,000 hardcore troops defending them, they now may be down to a handful, or, you know, as maybe as many as 20, but not much of a problem for a larger military unit.
So it's just a matter of scouring the countryside or going down into the caves.
Well, it may be an individual cave, but the area has been tightened a lot. I mean, where he can go on foot or in the immediate area, it's not as large an area as it used to be.
We're talking about the last stand of Al-Qaeda in the Tora Bora area of Afghanistan near the Pakistan border. It looks as though the fighting in Afghanistan, the main part of it, may be very nearly and completely over. Has the Afghan campaign made you feel safer? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. I want to bring in now Jack Schroeder. He's professor of geography and geology at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. In the 1970s, he directed the Atlas of Afghanistan project, which produced very detailed maps of this region. Good evening, Jack Schroeder.
How are you this evening?
We're well. Thanks very much for joining us. Tell us about the caves of Tora Bora and the area around there. What kind of stone are the caves made of? How are they configured? What is this battle going on top of?
Well, there are a multiplicity of caves in that area. They've been built. Afghans have been building caves for thousands of years. They built them for defensive purposes. They built them for obtaining underground water. The Tora Bora area has got caves that are in gravel, which are no particular problem. There are also caves that are in hard bedrock, hard crystalline bedrock. There are several areas. Tora Bora is one of them, and there's another one south of there whose name I'm not supposed to mention.
All right.
Where probably bin Laden has been heading for. We know of at least three sets of bunkers in southeastern Afghanistan that Al-Qaeda people have built and set up to protect their important people, bin Laden, Mullah Omar, and so forth, and they are capable of holding lots of people. They were built with concrete and steel underneath very tough crystalline rock, and they're pretty large.
So would they be heading there with the idea, if they went, would it be to really defend in a true last stand, or would they go there because they are escapable points?
Well, I don't know. Two sets of them were built close to the border, and they're escape points. Their only reason to build them that close to the border would be to try and escape. The other reason would, of course, to try and survive, because they were built with multiple entrances and exits, with a lot of steel and concrete, to presumably defend them against heavy bombs. So I presume they think they're going to make it out alive through this whole business. Sending people underground, ultimately, I don't think we want to just blow the caves up and bury them under tons of rocks, because then we wouldn't know where he'd gone. I think we're prepared for that, but I don't think it's the greatest idea in the world, because we wouldn't know whether we got him or not.
Mm. But as you describe it, Jack Schroeder, it sounds like we know where these bunkers, these caves are. Is that true?
Well, we know where several of them are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we definitely do. I always felt that if they've got three that we know about, maybe there's three more that we don't. But I have no proof of that. It's just my suspicious nature that if people are spending that much money to build big bunkers, that they probably got quite a few of them.
Michael Vickers, on the ground, how would U.S. Forces and the Afghan forces with them go about searching out these deep buried bunkers?
Well, most of the fighting around Tora Bora has really been large-scale assault, where the locations are generally known. Because the Al-Qaeda forces have been exchanging mortar fire and small arms fire with the Afghan opposition.
Right, but Jack Schroeder is suggesting that there may be other points where they're hiding, not fighting.
Well, that's right. I think there really is a series of these caves there that not the entire force is engaged at one time. And so the frontline forces provide a screening or delaying action for the others. And that's one way bin Laden might elude capture, at least for a while.
So how do you track down deeply buried bunkers once the shooting stops if you haven't found them? What's the procedure?
Well, there are technical sensors that can be brought to bear, thermal, and some that can detect heat coming out of some caves. There are ground-penetrating radars in some cases that can be used once you own the real estate and you're looking for a fugitive. We have these surveillance drones overhead for 24 hours at a time that can look for any signs of excavation or entrance activity around entrances. But then also, don't forget there's this $25 million reward, and there's a lot of locals in the area, and that's where a lot of the intelligence lead is coming from as well.
Jack Schroeder, how long might Osama bin Laden and followers with him survive in these deep bunkers?
Well, I mean, the bunkers are built big enough with enough munitions and enough food, enough diesel to run the generators for a long time.
What does that mean, a long time?
Well, months.
Wow.
But Mr. Vickers is right. $25 million in Afghanistan, where you have people that are making, only a few hundred dollars a year on average. Anyway, $25 million talks to a lot of those people. And a lot of Afghans never wanted Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in their country anyway. And they'll be out looking, doing the best they can, putting their lives at risk to try and identify where those guys might be. So I think the local intelligence community, homegrown as it might be, is going to be one of the best sources of information to our side. And that's probably where the strongest advances will be made, with local intelligence.
Jack Schroeder, Michael Vickers, stand by. We've got callers who want to join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Listeners, do you have a taste for more war? How does the effort need to change to evolve as we go forward? And do you think that we will end up with Osama bin Laden? Will it feel like victory if we don't? Josh is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Josh. You're on the line.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to go back to your point earlier. Has the action in Afghanistan made me feel safer?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to say that to a degree, yes, insofar as we have destroyed a good chunk of the infrastructure that made the extremists so so effective on, say, September 11th. But on the other hand, given the number of soldiers and backers of Al-Qaeda that have simply walked away from a lot of battles, I'm not completely feeling much safer just because they are still out there. And though they might not have the backers, they could very easily have slipped away and could still be active.
Let me put that to Michael Vickers. Josh raises this issue of the number of soldiers that have slipped away, that have melted back into the civilian population. The Bush administration was saying just today that for low-level Taliban soldiers, that was all right with them. There wasn't much else they could do once they'd defeated those troops, but have them go back home. But Michael Vickers, what about it? Could a guerrilla challenge still rise up out of soldiers who have left the points of combat in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't think in Afghanistan, but Josh raised a good point about mid-level Al-Qaeda troops who are there in Afghanistan basically to learn international terrorism and generally have had false passports and a range of things to get there. And while it will likely be a lot more difficult for them after we've captured a lot of the documents explaining their presence there for them to operate internationally, they still pose a threat. There are also the Al-Qaeda sleeper cells around the world that we haven't discovered yet, and so there remains a threat from them as well.
Josh, thanks for your call. Jack Schroeder, I know you're not a military strategist, so you look at it maybe more like the rest of us, except that you know the terrain better. Do you worry about an ongoing guerrilla campaign out of the very difficult geography and geology of Afghanistan that you know so well?
Well, it's possible, but the thing that bothered me the most in 1989, once the Soviet Union left, is that we left too, and I had expected to be one of the people to go back to that country and help rebuild it. And leaving it a vacuum in the 1990s so that the Wahhabis, Al-Qaeda, and bin Laden were able to operate in that vacuum, that very much bothered me.
We paid a high price for that.
We paid a very high price for that. I spent an hour in the State Department this summer talking about that very problem, that terrorism was breeding in Afghanistan, and please let us get back there and get to work to rebuild the country, because I really like the Afghan people. The State Department at the time said, sorry, we don't have any money. There's no plans to do anything in Afghanistan.
Wow.
And I said, I think that's a big mistake. And of course, little did I know it was coming in 2 months.
You were so right. And we know how focused you are at the University of Nebraska, many people there on Afghanistan. What are the early signs from where you sit that a better effort at follow-up on war is being prepared this time?
Well, now we're being told that we're now going to go back and rebuild the country. I have an American presence and have a European presence and a UN presence in the country.
Do you believe it? Are you ready to buy that?
I'm ready to buy it, and I'm ready to help with it, even though I'm 62 years old. I'm hoping that we're going to do the right thing and get back in there. We have lots and lots of Afghans who are very well educated, who left the country, who now want to go home and help. Some of the ones here at the university are ready to go back. They don't expect to die there, but they wouldn't mind being buried in the country of their birth. They want to go back and help. They have the education, the knowledge, and the interest to do it. And I hope that that the world is going to pay attention to Afghanistan now, rather than letting it be the world's dumping ground for terrorism and a whole lot of other unholy actions.
Jack Schroeder, we hear your passion and your optimism, and we're heartened by it. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Jack Schroeder is professor of geography and geology at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. We've got callers who want to join the conversation. Let's invite them in. We're talking about Al-Qaeda's last stand. It's going on right now. Has the Afghan campaign made you feel safer? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jeffrey's on the line. Hi, Jeffrey.
Yeah, hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, if bin Laden is captured or killed, do your guests expect that retaliation in the United States has been pre-planned?
That's a good question. Michael Vickers, what about it? Is there a bomb waiting to go off when and if Osama bin Laden is captured or killed?
Well, there's been this fear that he could issue some kind of doomsday signal, and that's why the administration has been very reluctant to have any tapes shown of him, although now they may reverse themselves because of this incriminating evidence apparently on this latest tape that's been discovered. But
his death would surely be signal enough.
That's right. I mean, it's a symbolic signal. But on the positive side of that is that bin Laden is now really being discredited a lot in the Islamic world, that because he's been defeated so easily, his legitimacy is being attacked in a number of Islamic media outlets. And to what extent that dampers the fervor for this kind of retaliation. It won't do it for the professional al-Qaeda sleeper cell, but it might make recruitment more difficult for future cells.
Mm-hmm. Michael Vickers, stand by. We're joined now by Ali Jalali. He's a former Afghan army colonel who fought against the Soviets in the 1980s. He's now chief of the Farsi service for the Voice of America. He's co-author of The Other Side of the Mountain, Mujahideen Tactics in the Soviet-Afghan War. Good evening, Ali Jalali.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Our callers were just asking about what it will mean when and if Osama bin Laden is captured and perhaps dies in this fight. What's your sense of that, how the Middle East will respond? Michael Vickers points out that there's been some pulling away from bin Laden in recent days.
Well, bin Laden has finished in Afghanistan. He lost his credibility long ago. As far as for his followers in other countries, I think they will think twice after what happened to him in an al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan. At least they will realize that these al-Qaeda were fighting Muslim brother Muslims in Afghanistan. Therefore, the misery they brought to the people of Afghanistan probably will something that people or his followers or those who are about to be sympathetic to them or be their potential sympathizer will probably think twice to follow him.
And Ali Jalali, what about the challenge of simply capturing Osama bin Laden? American forces, as far as we know, do not know exactly where he is. You know that terrain. You've fought, as far as I understand, around Tora Bora. Will he be captured, do you think?
Well, that's a very tough terrain, difficult terrain. I think that a part of the al-Qaeda fighters in that terrain probably will take advantage of the difficult area, difficult terrain and position that they had there, have there, and they will fight on. And probably and most likely that Osama bin Laden will either get away or be killed.
Get away by going down the valleys into Pakistan? How would you imagine he would escape from that region?
Well, it depends that if he finds a way to slip away and get away to Pakistan through tribal areas, probably they will try that to just prolong this the last battle of his.
So the cover, some cover might give him the chance to slip away through that rugged terrain toward Pakistan.
Yeah, that's a possibility, but I'm not sure. Maybe he will just fight to the last.
How would a person do that? Could you go on foot how would you cross that terrain?
Well, in that area, there are two gorges, two canyons reaching south. In the Spingar or White Mountains. One is the Agam Gorge and the other one is Waziro Gorge. And
Ali Jalali, we'll have to come back. We'll come right back and look at that terrain more closely and where Osama bin Laden may be. We've got to take a short break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Will the Afghan campaign feel like a victory without Osama bin Laden being tracked down? Or do you think he will be? Call us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
From Boston,
this is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking tonight at al-Qaeda's last stand and where the war on terror might go from here. It's hard to believe only not so many weeks since the first bombs dropped. We're hearing a very positive report tonight from Michael Vickers, a former CIA and Special Forces officer, about the situation in Afghanistan and really globally saying that al-Qaeda has been seriously disrupted. What do you think? Do you buy it? Has the Afghan campaign made you feel safer? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Fred is on the line. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi. Part of the thing that kept me a bit baffled about this cave defense.
Yes.
I mean, it seems almost like a primitive place to hide, given today's technology. Once you identify a cave and realize that there's more than one inlet to it, which you can do with thermal imaging, as they say, and has a number of ventilation shafts, et cetera, leading to and from it, it's just a matter of closing them off and pumping it full of noxious materials.
Fred, you're breaking up on us, but I think we've got your point. Let me put it to Ali Jalali. He's a former Afghan army colonel joining us tonight. Is it that simple, Ali Jalali, to once you know there's a network of caves, to simply seal it off? And Fred is suggesting, you know, somehow pump it full of gas or use explosives to kill whoever's in there. Is it that simple around Tora Bora?
A defensive position, wherever it will be, when it is isolated, it is going to collapse finally. I think Tora Bora is an area which, despite the fact that there are caves, there are bunkers and positions located in key on areas, but the people that the surrounding area is not under control of the defenders. People are trying to dislodge them. The environment is very hostile to the defenders. So it means that the time is not on their side. Whether you use the gas or not, they will collapse eventually as you see that they are collapsing.
Let's get one more call in. Kaz is on the line. Welcome, Kaz. You're on the air.
Hello. The thing about this that makes me feel a little better about the world is that about 8 years ago, when we pulled out of Somalia after a battle in which 18 American soldiers were killed,
yes,
we learned, I think, the wrong lesson, and we started leaving all these places in the world that were deteriorating into chaos, and we let them fester, and we said, well, you know, if we go in and help them and they kill our soldiers, it's not our problem. Let's pull out.
So what do you think is the lesson we've learned now, Kaz?
I think that the next time something like a Rwandan genocide or a Bosnian civil war comes up, I think we'll be quicker to react, and I think we need to. And I hope we also go back to places like Somalia, which still has no government, and we don't let them continue festering, because we know that we can help, and if we don't help, it could come back to bite us.
There can be a cause and effect. That could hardly have been made more clear. Kaz, thanks for your call. Michael Vickers, what about it? Kaz is bringing up really next steps. There are reports today of U.S. Military representatives being in Somalia. Do you think that the U.S. military and Bush administration are now going to want to go on around the world sort of cauterizing, sealing up these areas where government has frayed and order has frayed?
Well, a number of the problems really aren't directly amenable to direct military solutions.
Mm-hmm.
In Somalia, for example, the previous caller just indicated, the government doesn't really have any control, so it couldn't help us if it wanted to. And so while there could be a very limited strike if there were a concentration of al-Qaeda forces at some remote camp, once they're identified, they're vulnerable. But the longer-term challenge in a place like that is restoring some degree of order.
And that really goes to development aid, you're saying, not military intervention.
Right. Or in Europe, for example, it's intelligence and law enforcement cooperation. In the Philippines, it might be security assistance with the insurgency they have festering in the south. So it isn't really one size fits all around the world, but a series of different tools that we can bring to bear.
Michael Vickers, we're coming to the end of our time, but a last question. Is this going to feel like a victory if Osama bin Laden is not in hand?
Well, if he's under some rubble where we really don't know where he is, but he's not heard from, I think over time it will clearly look like a victory. And if al-Qaeda's operations are diminished, if he's on the run but not active, it's still a victory, and I think he'll get caught. And but I think there's still pretty good odds that he is going to get in hand.
And Ali Jalali, what do you think? What kind of, if Osama bin Laden is cornered and can't get out, what kind of end do you think he would seek that he would see as serving his agenda with public opinion in the Islamic world?
Well, he would like to stage a final show, a glorious show for the people who are probably follow him in the future. However, there's one point here, that here he is not fighting against infidels, so-called infidels, as he called them.
Mm-hmm.
He's fighting against Muslims, and therefore that is going to take that opportunity from him to die in glory.
And Michael Vickers, what do you think about how the U.S. military would like to handle that end game with Osama bin Laden himself? What's their ideal ending to that story?
Well, I think, as Colonel Jalali just said, it would be probably ideal from the world's point of view if Afghan opposition forces were to bring justice to him.
And do you think that they're most likely to do that? They're far more numerous than U.S. forces there.
I think so. I think that's the likely outcome.
Michael Vickers, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Colonel Ali Jalali, thank you for being on air with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ali Jalali is a former Afghan Army colonel who fought against the Soviets in the 1980s. Michael Vickers is a former CIA and Special Forces officer. He's now Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C. To view a photo gallery of fighting in Tora Bora, go to our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. This week, we're presenting a series with the Project for Muslim Understanding. It's a group formed out of the attacks on America, which consists of six Muslim PhD candidates from across the country. They've come together to analyze the global trends which contributed to the events of September 11th. Each has researched a specific problem and then has written on it. For today's installment, we're joined now by David Daycake. He's an American Muslim convert who's currently a PhD candidate in the Religion Department at Temple University. His paper is entitled, Combating the Myth of a Monolithic Militant Islam. David Daycake, what inspired you to take off on this paper?
Well, the subject of my paper really comes out of my having listened to a nationally syndicated radio show, as a matter of fact, a few days after the events of September 11th, where the radio announcer was sort of rattling off verses of the Quran taken completely out of context in order to justify his sort of anti-Islamic polemical point of view. Verses like, kill them wherever you find them, do not take Christians and Jews as friends, fight against the infidels and the hypocrites. And in particular, after he mentioned this verse, he said, ladies and gentlemen, you know, the infidels and the hypocrites, that's us, meaning his American audience. And as I was listening to this, I also was thinking, of course, about the recent quote-unquote fatwa, religious edict of Osama bin Laden making acceptable, supposedly, the killing of civilians and the rallies in favor of him in various places in the Islamic world. And I was just thinking,
not to mention the events of September 11th themselves, which seemed to have a lot of religious inspiration behind them.
Yes. But I was thinking about these two sort of points of view, and I thought how ironic it is that there are some people in the Islamic world who are actually willing to interpret the Quran and what it says about issues of jihad and fighting in the same way as this radio announcer was willing to misinterpret the Quran.
It is ironic, but help us also with the perception. It seems that there are not just some, but a lot of people in the Islamic world willing to interpret the Quran in that way.
Well, I think that issue is not exactly the case. I mean, the Islamic world is a big place, certainly. But also you have the fact that there is more than just issues of religion involved here.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a great deal of politics involved, which makes it a very messy business, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you put people in a situation where they're under a great deal of economic, cultural, military pressure as well, this can be a kind of breeding ground for extremism. That has been the case in terms of the U.S. policy towards the region. It has not been a very benign one, despite what we may think as Americans. The fact of the matter is that the U.S. government does not support, let's say, freedom of expression and individual human rights in the region. And consequently, the way that U.S. policy is perceived within that Islamic world is very different than the way we think we are acting in that world.
So we understand there's a political backdrop. Then when Muslims turn to the Quran, do they find more support there for a militant response in their anger than they might in some other religious books?
No, I would say no. No more support than, let's say, Christianity had for the Crusades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what happened to the religion of love and loving your neighbor? It became, you know, something that was used to make the streets of Jerusalem run with blood. Any religion has the potential for militancy, but it's a question of also adding to that situation all kinds of other political and social pressures generated in large part by Western actions within the Islamic world that have brought about this kind of reaction.
So we understand there are grounds for complaint and deep complaint. But let me ask you, David Daycake, where are, even in that environment, where are the great Islamic unifiers? Where's the Muslim Mandela, the Muslim Gandhi, the Martin Luther King?
Well, one example would be, let's say, Sheikh Abdul Qadir, who was a Sufi, a mystic, and had a very universalistic point of view on, let's say, Islamic relations with other peoples, other religions, and defended with his own life Christian churches and Christian citizens of the Islamic Empire. So there are cases like that. Unfortunately, those voices are not being heard quite as much today, and that's something that we're trying to change, particularly by what the work that we're doing here.
And what about in the schools in the Middle East and the Islamic world? Are they teaching a version of the Quran that is mindful of its lessons of tolerance and peace?
Well, I think that what you have today in the Islamic world, I mean, for instance, here we get into the question of Wahhabism and what that has done in many of the poorer parts of the Islamic world.
This is the puritanical strain of Islam promoted by the Saudi family.
Yes, royal family. Right.
What has its impact been?
Well, its impact has been immense. You know, the Saudis have a great deal of money, and money creates a situation of influence. And there has been a kind of alliance between the Saud family and the Wahhabi brand of puritanical Islam since the founding of Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
You can just imagine if you have a very wealthy person coming in and building a school in a place where people, you know, they barely have enough money to feed themselves.
And you're saying those Wahhabi-backed schools would not be promoting a view of Islam that emphasized its more compassionate face?
No, they would be promoting a very literal interpretation of the Quran that, in fact, rejects or ignores most of what is the traditional Islamic scholarship on the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet and things like that.
David Daycake, you began our conversation quoting some of the scriptural lines that you say have been taken out of context, which suggest a militant Islam. Let's go out on some line of scripture that conveys a more compassionate aspect of Islam. Can you quote something for us?
Sure. Well, probably the best verse is that verse which says, "Those who believe and those who say we are Jews and we are Christians and we are Sabians." Sabians probably refers to people who were followers of St. John the Baptist. "All who believe in God and the last day, they have their reward with their Lord, and neither shall they fear nor grieve." So I think that this verse clearly shows, indeed, the tolerance and universality of the Islamic message in terms of how it views other faiths.
David Daycake, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
David Daycake is a PhD candidate in the Religion Department at Temple University. His paper is entitled "Combating the Myth of a Monolithic Militant Islam." Tomorrow we'll talk to another Muslim PhD candidate about his paper, "The Roots of Misconception, Islam and the West." Listeners, we want to know about the music you've turned to since September 11th. What are you listening to for strength, for hope, to grieve, or to escape? Has it been the blues of Billie Holiday, Copeland's American Anthems, something pop? Email us at special@wbur.org. Let us know what you've been listening to and why you've turned to that music. Make sure to include your email address so that we can contact you for a future show. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is WBUR. We're